Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Nick Miles, and in the early hours of Wednesday, the 25th of September, these are our main stories. Democrats in the US have opened formal impeachment proceedings against President Trump. The Supreme Court says suspending the British Parliament was unlawful. A warning for Tehran at the UN General Assembly. Also in this podcast...
Something to mention is about the food in space. Since we have our Arabic food, actually, we will be eating that in space. Blalit, Madruba, and Saluna.
Today, the first astronaut from the United Arab Emirates will board a Soyuz spacecraft in Kazakhstan. Since he took office, there have been many calls from Democrats to impeach President Trump over allegations of collusion with Russia or improper payments to individuals. They all drifted away. But now the leader of the House of Representatives, Nancy Pelosi, a Democrat, says impeachment proceedings will start against the president.
The actions of the Trump presidency revealed the dishonorable fact of the president's betrayal of his oath of office, betrayal of our national security, and betrayal of the integrity of our elections. Therefore, today, I'm announcing the House of Representatives moving forward with an official impeachment inquiry. I'm directing our six committees to proceed with their investigations under that umbrella of impeachment inquiry. The president must be held accountable. No one is above the law.
Well, the impeachment is being brought over allegations he used his public office to his own advancement by trying to pressure Ukraine's new president, Volodymyr Zelensky, to set up a corruption investigation into the Democratic Party presidential hopeful Joe Biden and his son. So why now? David Willis is our Washington correspondent.
What's tipped the balance here is this suggestion that President Trump used his office basically to lean on the leader of a foreign country in order to dig the dirt on a political rival, in this case, Joe Biden. And what Nancy Pelosi announced in the last hour is historic, clearly. It could make Donald Trump only the third president in U.S. history to be impeached. Ms. Pelosi met with members of the Democratic caucus and then said from the Speaker's gallery that, balcony, I should say, that she believes the president's broken the law by prohibiting a whistleblower's report to be brought before Congress and that he betrayed the office by seeking to solicit the help of a foreign power. No one, she said, is above the law.
Meanwhile, the president says it's witch hunt garbage. Some people feel that starting impeachment proceedings against President Trump this close to a general election could actually give him a boost amongst his supporters. One assumes the Democrats don't feel like that at the moment.
Well, it's a very good point because Nancy Pelosi had been, there have been calls for her to institute impeachment proceedings on several occasions in the past, but she'd always resisted, fearing that they could backfire to the point where they would boost President Trump's popularity amongst his base. But the momentum has been building in the last few days in such a way to the point where more than two-thirds of the Democratic caucus in the House of Representatives, even though those in Republican-leaning seats favoured impeachment proceedings. I think the feeling generally was that the Rubicon had been crossed, to use a phrase that's been in much circulation over the last few days. This was all beyond the pale and that Congress would be complicit, it was felt, if it did nothing in the face of these allegations.
That was David Willis. And in case you were trying to rack your brain to remember who were the two US presidents who have been impeached so far, it was Richard Nixon, of course, and Bill Clinton. Well, a few hours before this news broke, a rather subdued-looking Donald Trump was under a different spotlight at the United Nations General Assembly in New York. His address focused on patriotism. He said the future belongs to sovereign and independent nations who protect their citizens and honour the differences that make each country special and unique. He also called on other countries to increase pressure on Iran, which he blames for attacking oil facilities in Saudi Arabia.
In response to Iran's recent attack on Saudi Arabian oil facilities, we just imposed the highest level of sanctions on Iran's central bank and sovereign wealth fund. All nations have a duty to act. No responsible government should subsidize Iran's bloodlust.
Commentators have noted that Mr. Trump sounded downbeat in his delivery during that speech to the UN. I asked our correspondent in New York, Laura Trevelyan, if she agreed.
Well, yes, it was, and certainly it seemed to some degree to be an effort to tamper down expectations when it comes to Iran of a strong US response in defence of Saudi Arabia, of course a staunch US ally in the Middle East. For example, President Trump didn't repeat the line of his Secretary of State, Mike Pompeo, who labelled those attacks on Saudi facilities as an act of war. So, yes, it seemed much more a speech aimed at a domestic audience, with the president just a year away from re-election, in which he talked about how the future doesn't belong to globalists, it belonged to patriots. So it was more of his America first and a strong defence of his line on the Chinese with trade, rather than more of a global outreach kind of a speech.
He's clearly still trying to isolate Iran further at the UN. What kind of response is that having and likely to have?
Well, the significant response really on that front was last night when the leaders of Britain, Germany and France took the American side in blaming Iran for the September 14th attacks on Saudi Arabia. They issued a joint statement that not only accused Iran of responsibility for the attacks, but also called on Iran to begin negotiating on broader issues than its nuclear program. So that statement absolutely aligns with Washington's position on both the Saudi attacks and the demand for a stronger nuclear deal. And it did represent a major shift in Europe's position of tolerance with Iran.
Laura Trevelyan. Westminster is famously known as the Mother of Parliaments. The actions of the government of the day there have by and large been known for their respect for the laws of the land. And that perception has now been shaken to its very foundations. The Supreme Court has overruled the government's decision to suspend or prorogue Parliament in the run-up to Brexit, saying that it was unlawful. The President of the Court, Lady Hale, announced the unanimous decision.
The court is bound to conclude, therefore, that the decision to advise Her Majesty to prorogue Parliament was unlawful because it had the effect of frustrating or preventing the ability of Parliament to carry out its constitutional functions without reasonable justification.
Boris Johnson, who's in New York for that UN General Assembly, gave his reaction.
I strongly disagree with this decision of the Supreme Court. I have utmost respect for our judiciary. I don't think this was the right decision. I think that the prerogative of prorogation has been used for centuries without this kind of challenge. But more importantly, let's be in no doubt, there are a lot of people who want to frustrate Brexit. There are a lot of people who basically want to stop this country coming out of the EU.
The opposition Labour Party leader Jeremy Corbyn has called on Boris Johnson to resign. Rob Watson is our political correspondent.
It's hard to imagine a more difficult ruling for the Prime Minister because in many ways they questioned his judgment, they questioned the competence and trustworthiness of his government. And of course they've made life very difficult because essentially they've put it out there that he gave unlawful advice to the Queen, and it's hard to imagine anything much more serious than that. But of course, most of all, this now means politicians are returning to Westminster and will be able to ask all those awkward questions which the Prime Minister and his team had been anxious to avoid, according to the court.
Absolutely. Boris Johnson will be flying back from New York for those reopening of Parliament. What can he expect over the next 24 hours? You mentioned questions. What awkward questions?
Well, let me take first of all the attitude that Mr. Johnson has taken. And I think it's been interesting because anyone thinking he might be inclined to back down, it seems to me absolutely the reverse is the case. And rather, he's sort of doubling down on the whole Brexit business. So he's saying, yes, I accept the judgment of the court. But he's essentially saying he disagrees with it. And he's also putting it, if you like, in this sort of populist message of his that it's judges, it's other politicians who are trying to stand in the way of the people's Brexit. Now, what is he going to face when he gets back, given that he's decided to go down that sort of do or die, keep with the Brexit message? Well, of course, he's going to face lots of taunting from opposition MPs and lots of suggestions that he should resign.
Well, how then is the British Supreme Court judgment being viewed across the channel by the European Union? Adam Fleming is our Brussels correspondent.
The official reaction from the EU is that they don't comment on internal domestic constitutional matters, and that this is a matter for the British system, the British courts, the British Parliament to process. They're keeping out of it. Then you talk to people in private and you get a range of views. You get people who are just quite astonished, and then you get the people saying this is good for British democracy because they thought that what Boris Johnson had done by suspending Parliament for 5 weeks was a bit anti-democratic, and a few people are pleased that that's been reversed. Then you get some people who are a bit closer to the process and the actual talks that are going on between the UK and the EU, and who are a little bit worried about this because they think it adds a huge dose of instability to the British political system. And that is just summed up in those words, what happens next?
What indeed? What will the court judgment mean for Boris Johnson's promise, which he reiterated, that the UK will leave the EU on October the 31st, come what may? Here's our reality check correspondent, Chris Morris.
Mr. Johnson's best hope of delivering Brexit still lies in securing a deal with other EU leaders at their summit in Brussels on October the 17th, and then persuading the House of Commons to back it. That remains a tall order. The UK and the EU are poles apart on the potential detail of any revised deal. And even if a compromise were to be stitched together, there may not be a majority in the House of Commons willing to approve it. The Prime Minister's other declared option is to take the UK out of the EU with no Brexit deal. But that would be in defiance of the law passed recently by MPs designed explicitly to rule out no deal. So it now looks increasingly unlikely. If Mr. Johnson were to try to ignore the law, the Supreme Court would almost certainly be asked for its opinion again.
Chris Morris. Today, a man from the United Arab Emirates will make history. Hazza Mansouri will board a Soyuz spacecraft in Kazakhstan to be blasted into space, where he'll spend 8 days aboard the International Space Station. He's the first Arab to set foot on the orbiting laboratory. Georgia Tolley spoke to Hazza and his backup colleague Sultan Al-Nayadi ahead of their trip to Kazakhstan.
My name is Hazza Ali Al-Mansouri, and currently I am astronaut in Mohammed bin Rashid Space Center.
My name is Sultan Al-Nayadi. I'm the backup for our mission.
Ever since you got chosen and it was announced to the media, you guys have been doing quite a bit of training.
So we started with the Russian language, with the Soyuz training, and also we started to learn more about the International Space Station and how to conduct the daily routine there. The Soyuz, the spacecraft will take us to space, is all in Russian. The first time I sit in the Soyuz, it's all in Russian. For me, it's like alien letters there. Oh, how come I will learn all of this?
Have you managed to learn Russian then?
Да, конечно. That was, of course.
So apart from learning Russian, you're both looking very sort of slim and fit. As astronauts, I imagine there's quite a lot of physical training.
Both of us, me and Hazza, come from a military background. And training for space is not something different.
We train to be fit in general, and to strengthen our muscles, because in microgravity on board the International Space Station, this is one of the weakest parts of our body that will get really affected, our legs, because we are not going to use them, because we are floating all the time. Something to mention is about the food in space. Since we have our Arabic food, actually, we will be eating that in space. Balalit, madruba, and saluna.
So those three dishes, are they going to like freeze dry them for you? Have you got people working on that?
Actually, we tried them after they processed them to be ready for our mission. And they really taste same as on Earth. I'm looking forward to make the other astronauts try it and give their feedback about it.
It's very easy to talk about all the sort of fun stuff around going to space, but it is also a very, very dangerous thing to do. Do you feel nervous about it?
For me, I think the overwhelming feeling is thrilled. I am proud to be representing my country in this mission. And to be prepared, it will give me that courage to face any abnormal scenarios.
Well, space is tough. Space is unpredictable. Anything is possible. So you have to trust in your knowledge, the training that you receive. You have to trust in your equipment, your spacecraft. The examples are many. Last year, there was a failure in one of the launches, but the Russian cosmonaut and the American astronaut, they were able to come back safely to Earth, following procedures and trusting in their equipments. So, yes, you have to be vigilant, but I don't think it's pure fear. It's kind of readiness to expect any abnormal event.
This is only the beginning. In future, planning to go to Moon and beyond.
That was Hassan Mansouri, and you also heard from his backup colleague, Sultan Al-Nayadi. Still to come on this podcast.
I grew up playing with able-bodied people. They just say, yeah, you're very strong. You had the Terminator, you had the Arnold Schwarzenegger.
We hear from a footballer without a foot who's represented his country. A 5.8 magnitude earthquake has struck eastern Pakistan, killing more than 20 people and injuring hundreds of others. The quake's epicentre was close to the city of Mirpur in Pakistan-administered Kashmir. Farhana Dawood reports.
This quake hit around 4 p.m. on Tuesday afternoon, local. Rescue operations are still underway throughout the night. Soldiers are handing out tents and blankets. The immediate tremors from the quake lasted for under 30 seconds, but the damage was really quite significant. We know that at least 26 people have lost their lives and hundreds of others are injured, some of them with very critical injuries indeed. There are images on social media of roads buckling, massive craters in roads, with cars stuck in those craters. I've seen a video of people fleeing a building which seconds later totally collapses. Even very strong, sturdy buildings like that at the University of Mirpur, I've seen images of walls on the campus with massive cracks in them. The authorities are warning that people need to take extra care as aftershocks over the next 24 hours are very likely indeed. Though the quake was so powerful that tremors were in fact felt as far away as the Indian capital Delhi, spare a thought for the people in next door Indian-administered Kashmir, whose mobile phone and internet services remain switched off by the Indian government. They are unable to get information about family members just next door in Pakistani-administered Kashmir, who might well have been affected by the quake.
That was Farhana Dawood reporting. Now, to an extraordinary discovery in the world of fine art. A painting discovered hanging in an elderly woman's home near Paris turns out to be a long-lost masterpiece from Italy. She thought it was a religious icon, but an eagle-eyed valuer spotted it when the house was being cleared. Now, the 13th century Mocking of Christ by the Florentine artist Cimabue is being prepared for auction next month in France. Part of the team getting it ready for the sale is the art expert Eric Turquin. He spoke to James Menendez.
Well, it's crucial. First, because there are only 10 pictures known by this artist Cimabue. And second, because Cimabue is a crucial figure in the 13th century. He's the creator, the first Occidental artist, really. He starts from the Greek tradition, the Byzantine tradition, very erratic, very stiff, and he's bringing humanity into paintings. And that's why this picture is so touching.
What sort of condition is it in? I understand it was hung in this woman's kitchen and above her hot plate. Is that right?
Not exactly. Luckily, it wasn't. It was 1 meter away from the oven. But it was forgotten. It was considered as an icon, you know. And the genius, the intelligence of the local auctioneer, Philomène Wolf, you know, was to think that it was not an icon, but that it could be an accidental picture. To find that it was by Cimabue was very easy, actually.
How do you know it is definitely by Cimabue, that it's authentic?
First, because it is the same hand as the London painting. You know, the National Gallery bought a picture that had been Cimabue, that had been discovered in the country, in the Gouache collection, in 2000. And I went to see that picture, and it's definitely the same hand. And you have the same instrument has drawn the line on the top of the painting. Moreover, the panel is the same, and there are woodworms traces in the panel of the National Gallery that go into our picture. This panel was one panel until 1820.
This is obviously radio, and painting's a visual medium. Can you give us a sense of what makes this so special, why you think it's so beautiful?
Well, it's the quality of the expression, and it's a group of about 20 people. In the middle, there is a space, and there is standing this longer, higher figure of Christ. But in his face, you know, he has an expression. He accepts. He's very sad. You can see the sadness coming through. His hands are falling on his body. When the other figures of his attackers are very agitated, you know, there is a sense of activity. And he's so majestic in the middle. That's the beauty of the painting.
I'll have to ask you this. How much do you think it's going to sell for?
This artist has never come up at auction because the National Gallery snapped up that picture 18 years ago when it came up and they bought it directly before the sale. The only thing we know is that the estimate was £2 to £3 million, and apparently the rumour is that they paid £6 million in 2001. And it's exactly the same measurements, so we think it should fit at least £4 to £6 million.
Wow, that was the art specialist Eric Turquin speaking to James Menendez. One of France's best-known chefs is taking the authors of the Michelin Guide to court to try to force them to explain why they downgraded his restaurant earlier this year from 3 stars to 2. Marc Vera, who runs the Maison des Bois in Manigot in the French Alps, says that when he asked Michelin for the reasons behind his demotion, he was accused of violating the purity of his cuisine by putting cheddar in his cheese soufflé. From Paris, Hugh Schofield reports.
So it's come to this. Marc Vera, high priest of Alpine cuisine, champion of the high pastures and their subtle fromage, the Tomme, the Beaufort, the Reblochon, claims that when he asked the Michelin men to explain why they'd taken away his 3rd star, they said that he'd put cheddar in his cheese soufflé. Oh, the ignorance and the dishonour. In his account, Monsieur Vera claims that he'd actually scattered a bit of saffron in the soufflé, turning it yellow, and because of this, the inspectors had leapt to the conclusion that he'd abandoned his beloved mountain fare and resorted to a slab of Somerset's finest. Can it actually be true that the Michelin team cast this insult at the feet of one of France's most revered chefs? They deny it, saying that Monsieur Vera has willfully distorted a conversation that they had with him. What can't be hidden is the hysteria and the histrionics that the secretive Michelin star system still provokes, for all the warnings over the years that it's outmoded and irrelevant. When Marc Vera lost his 3rd star, he says it plunged him and his team into 6 months of depression. So he needs to know why it happened, and to make it quite clear to all who might still be in doubt, it wasn't cheddar.
That was Hugh Schofield. Now, here's another story you don't hear every day. A footballer without a foot who's represented his country. Kudakwashi Mapira was born with no left foot, but that hasn't stopped him playing with and usually outplaying able-bodied competitors as a boy and now into adulthood. He recently got his big break when he captained the Zimbabwe squad during this summer's Homeless World Cup. So let's hear from the man himself.
My name is Kudakwashi Mapira, but they call me Terminator, because I terminate. I started playing soccer when I was 7 years old, but in Zimbabwe I didn't get opportunities to play for professional leagues. They say because of your disability you can't play with able-bodied people. There were 2 teams tried to register me in the professional league. But the Zimbabwean football body, they say you can't play with the able-bodied. You should join leagues for disabled. In Zimbabwe, in Africa, we don't have such leagues, disabled leagues. So I keep on pushing, I keep on pushing. That's where my coach came, Coach Liberty. He said, come, I want you to come and train with my academy. And that's where I was selected to come and participate for the Zimbabwean Homeless World Cup. And now I'm the Zimbabwean team captain.
I'm Liberty Tapiwandewere, and I'm the Homeless World Cup Zimbabwe team coach. So as the case with the Terminator, due to his disability, he faces a lot of discrimination from the society. The only place where he can find hope and happiness is in the field of play. People ask him, where is your leg? Something like that. And they see him as an incomplete person, yet he is complete. He's just as good as all able-bodied players.
People call me Terminator since I was 6 years because they just saw me, how fit I am. Because I grew up playing with able-bodied people. They just say, ah, you're very strong. Yeah, the Terminator, yeah, the Arnold Schwarzenegger. Yeah, and I terminate. You can see the game we played. Yeah, I scored. 1-2, Buster! My parents, they are my heroes because they didn't restrict me. Play with able-bodied people.
They didn't limit me. They just say, no, go and play with your friends. And just come home when it's late, put your 100% effort so that will change our lives. Yeah, you can see the way we are living here. Yeah, it's not okay. We can't even afford to buy you even an artificial leg because it's very expensive in Africa. I would like to be the next Pep Guardiola, Alex Ferguson. Yeah, that's my dream. I would like to be a great coach so that I can coach able-bodied people. Be a disabled ambassador. Because sometimes when I want to go to work, they just say, ah, no, you can't. Of which I can.
Good job, well done.
The Terminator, Kadakwashi Mapira. And that's all from us for now, but there's going to be an updated version of the Global News podcast later on. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. I'm Nick Miles, and until next time, goodbye.